This is the Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
Hello and thanks for joining today's program. Maybe you're out on the water listening. Well, you might be interested in our first guest, Dr. Sean Tracy, one of the scientists behind an investigation into how much bluefin tuna wreck fishers are catching. And from tuna to wool, where's the market heading? That's what Australia's wool marketing body is trying desperately to work out.
It's very difficult to predict when you've got it literally every retail business in the world with their doors closed. What we're trying to understand is from our processes, whether they be in Italy or in China, what sort of orders are coming through for the fall and winter selling season. That's the Northern Hemisphere.
And scientists and farmers collaborating to discover the best pastures for those windblown north-facing paddocks in the Derwent Valley.
The animals keep on coming to the same areas to take shelter or to sunbake, as I said, and so we try and get a good mix of coxfoot and clover to try and bind the structure of the soil and everything together to hold it in place. As you can see where we are at the moment, it's taken a toll, and we need to do something about it.
Coming up later in the program, we'll also have Queen's Birthday Honours for a Victorian grain farmer. But first, have you been out on the water this long weekend? Or perhaps you're still out there, you lucky things. You might have a line and you're listening. You might have dropped a line and you're listening to the Country Hour. I hope so. Let us know how successful you've been. What have you caught out on the line? Or perhaps you've been diving for some scallops. Text the Country Hour on 0438 922 936. 0438 922 936. Now, if you're tuna fishing, how busy have you been? You might be interested in this interview. We're going to talk about bluefin tuna and recreational fishing. I'm joined by marine scientist Dr. Sean Tracy. Good afternoon, Dr. Tracy.
Good afternoon, Fiona.
Thanks for joining the Country Hour. Now, you've been involved in the survey of bluefin fishers across southern Australia, and that's been a recent survey.
Yeah, it has. It's been a very large national project that ran for 12 months from the 1st of December 2018 through to the end of November 2019.
And so in this survey, you've actually been contacting wreck fishers, whether they be in private boats or charter boats, and asking them a series of different questions.
Yeah, so given that it's been across multiple states, so we've been working in South Australia, Victoria, New South Wales and Tasmania, we've actually had to use different survey methods in different states, depending on what their if they've got a fishing license or not, or how many potential access points they'd have to the bluefin fishery. So, but yes, in theory, we have been speaking to recreational fishers all across southern Australia and talking to them about their southern bluefin tuna catch.
Now, I know that in Tasmania, we have about, one in four Tasmanians fish each year. But do many actually go for these big ones, the bluefin tuna?
All game fishing is a fairly niche fishery. So, unlike walking down to the beach and casting off the shore, you obviously need a boat to go out and catch southern bluefin tuna, and the fishing gear you need is also quite expensive. So there are plenty of people in Tasmania that enjoy the fishery, but compared to, as you said, the one in four, a much lower percentage of people are actually game fishing.
As you say, it's quite a niche fishery. It's not an easy fishery. You have to go out a fair way, I presume. What sort of questions did you ask people?
So in Tasmania, basically, the main thing we're looking at is catch. So how much catch have people been taking in the recreational sector? The reason we're doing that is Australia has an obligation to an international fisheries management organisation to report all sources of mortality of bluefin. So this is the first time that we've done a comprehensive assessment of the catch from the recreational sector. We know what the commercial guys catch. Yeah. And so basically, we've been asking the fishers, how much southern bluefin tuna do they catch, and also how many are they releasing? So we're looking at release rates as well.
And I suppose this informs policymakers and quota determinants?
It does. So traditionally, basically all of Australia's allocation of southern bluefin tuna has gone to the commercial sector. But obviously the recreational sector is an important component. And over the last 20 years or so, we have seen it grow. It ebbs and flows from year to year, but it has grown. So what it looks like is will happen now as a result of the survey is that the quota for the commercial sector will be reduced by a percentage, and then that percentage will now be available to the recreational sector. So it's business as usual, so nothing's changing, but what it means is it's just that the recreational catch is now truly represented in Australia's catch of southern bluefin tuna.
Oh, I thought it was interesting you're asking about release, and I think I had a look at, you had a small percentage, or 25%, I think it was, that actually release their tuna. Is this wreck fishers and those on private and on charter?
Look, it's an interesting one. So we actually did a similar survey in Tasmania back in 2011, and we have seen that the release rate has actually increased from the private boats, so that's, you know, private recreational fishers. It's gone up by about 2% from 24% to 26%. But in the charter sector, we've seen a very steep increase in that release rate. So in 2011, it was about 27%. It was about 14%, and it's gone up by 27% to about 41% being released. And one of the main reasons for that is in 2015 in Tasmania, a regulation was brought in with what's called a boat limit. So you couldn't take more than four southern bluefin tuna on a boat, which was a regulation brought in 2015.
Okay, so a few rules and regulations that might limit that. And do people, you know, were people pretty happy to be involved in this survey?
Yeah, we had really good response rates all around Australia. You know, we're very thankful to the recreational sector. It is a voluntary survey, and we had exceptional response rates both when we were doing our phone call surveys, but also our boat ramp surveys where we'd actually go to boat ramps and speak to people.
Is there anything else there that you found out that was of particular interest or that might be interesting to other fishers around the place?
Look, it's just interesting, you know, noting that it is a fishery. Fish do swim. The bluefin tuna that we have off Tasmania are actually part of a global stock. It's not like there is a Tasmanian stock of bluefin and a Victorian stock, or even an Australian and a South African stock. They're all the same fish that just move around the coast, and we're lucky enough to have access to them as they move in close to our shoreline. In Tasmania, they move in particularly close, so we're very lucky to be able to enjoy them, particularly off the Tasman Peninsula in the southeast. So it's just really interesting sort of exploring this at a national level and looking at the ebbs and flows of the fishery from year to year, but also between the states as well. So it's as a marine scientist, it's been quite an exciting project to work on.
Well, it is interesting when you say, because they're highly migratory, and they spawn in the northeast Indian Ocean off northwest Australia and south of Indonesia, and then sort of migrate all through the Southern Ocean, and as you said, coming quite close down south here.
Yes, they do. They have one known spawning ground up off northwest Western Australia, or probably closer to Indonesia. The juvenile fish move down the coast of Western Australia, so the recreational fishery there can access them as quite young fish, so they might only be 3 to 4 kilos average. Then they come and hang out in the Great Australian Bight for several years and move down around Tasmania. So there's a lot of what we call school fish, and they may be sort of, you know, 8 to 30 kilos. But in Tassie, you know, particularly around the southeast, you can be 5 minutes from a boat ramp and catching southern bluefin tuna, which is an amazing experience. And now we have a good handle on the numbers that are being caught. It is a snapshot, so it is only for 1 year, but we have a number there now which can help make sure that our recreational catch is being accounted for at an international level.
What was that number?
The national total was 270 tonne. So that's from Western Australia, South Australia, Tasmania, Victoria, New South Wales combined. And in Tasmania, we were about 83 tonne, which is a combination of both private boat and charter boat catch.
And it's the bluefin tuna season now. Do you know whether people are catching them at the moment?
They are. Yes, I was lucky enough to be out a week or two ago with Stuart Nichols, who's one of the charter operators down on the southeast coast. We were doing some filming for the Tuna Champions program, which is another initiative where we're encouraging wreck fishers to do the right thing with their catch, whether they're keeping it to retain to make sure they get good meat quality, or if they're releasing it to make sure that they've got the best chance of survival. We had a great day out on the water after being locked down for a while, like everyone else. And I spoke to him this morning, and there's apparently a lot of people down there this weekend enjoying the nice weather, and there's plenty of bluefin down there at the moment being caught.
And hopefully, you know, after getting that Tuna Champions program out there, people are looking after their fish, icing them down when they catch them, and making that meat a lot better for later on, or releasing them correctly so they live on.
Yeah, we are seeing some really positive changes, and particularly through social media, you know, people encouraging their mates to do the right thing as well. So if there's any bluefin fishermen that haven't checked it out, look at tunachampions.com.au. We're also on Facebook and Instagram.
Okay, Dr. Sean Tracy from the Institute of Marine and Antarctic Science, thanks so much for joining the Country Hour.
Pleasure. Thanks, Fiona.
Leon Compton.
Melinda Salter is a vet. What is your favourite animal to help make better?
I've treated dolphins before. I've treated seals.
Mel, Charlotte's got a question.
What do I need to do when I'm a vet? Because I'm going to be a vet when I grow up.
Well, Charlotte, I think you're already on your way because you're very enthusiastic, which is great, and that's what you have to do. In order to be a vet, you have to be really, really passionate.
Weekdays from 8:30 a.m. on ABC Radio Hobart.
The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
Now, Australian wool growers offered up a little more than 15,000 bales of wool last week, the lowest national offering since AWEX, the organisation, began its records back in 1995. The smaller market, though, boosted prices by 13 cents to close at 1,183 cents a kilogram. Fox and Lily wool brokerage manager Eamon Tim says small offerings are helpful as the industry finds its way through the COVID-19 fallout.
The market started to push up a little bit more after being at the Shadeer the week before. So the Eastern market indicator, with a 13-cent rise, finished at 11.83 for the week. And US cents, it was actually up 44 cents to 8.21, mainly because the Australian dollar pushed so much. Sort of spent early in the week, it was in the sort of 67.5 range, and by end of week, it was, you know, 69.5, 70 at one point on Thursday. So really, was quite a big push in the dollar, which you can relate to issues in the US there with what's going on with that instability that they're having over there. Their currency's going down, which is pushing up the basket of other world currencies, which we're part of. So, and also the iron ore price has been quite strong, so those couple of factors have been playing into our dollar being a lot stronger. Usually that can be a bit of a factor that pushes away a bit of business from the Chinese who buy in US dollars. But in this circumstance, the market's has got a lot of volume around it, and people have a few needs to get some wool, so they're still buying.
This price rise, though, comes on the back of what is the lowest national quantity offering since the AWEX records began. Is that a concern?
An offering of just over 15,000 bales, as you say, is a very small offering. Given how patchy the demand has become, having small offerings at the moment is actually helpful for the market. So we have seen this, you know, COVID situation, you know, being quite serious for our industry. And while people work out overseas where they're at, obviously China has still been buying, as we know. We've seen just a little bit of inquiry coming through from Europe and India in the last week after they were just completely stalled for, you know, the previous 6 to 7 weeks. So we just need a little bit of time, more time, for people to try and get a handle on what needs they're going to have, because at the moment there's still a fair bit of uncertainty. So these small quantities are really assisting while there's so much uncertainty. 15,000 bales in a week, to me, looks like the lowest volume offer in a week for decades. You know, it could be 40 years or if not more. So I think it's if you went back and were able to study all the records, this would be one that would really stand out.
A couple of months ago, wool stores were absolutely chock-a-block. Are they still filling up?
Managed to get a bit of wool out of store in the last sort of 4 to 6 weeks. Certainly the stores in our network are all very, very full to overflowing. When you're in that February, March period, exporters weren't shipping things quickly, so they were ordering it out, and we were still receiving grower wools, and there were some pass-ins and some growers who weren't wanting to offer because of the market situation. So all those factors combined to make wool stores everywhere very, very full. So it's certainly the situation has eased somewhat, but what has become apparent even with the easing, there's still a lot of wool in store that's either unsold or not offered by growers who are obviously concerned at the market levels and don't want to participate at the market levels, and also starting to be more reports now of growers who are leaving wool in sheds and not even sending it down to stores. That's just starting to become a little bit obvious in the last couple of weeks.
And that was Fox and Lily Wool Brokerage Manager Eamon Timms. Now, the wool industry's R&D marketing body, AWI, is reassessing how quickly the United States economy and retail sector will recover in light of recent race-related riots. CEO of Australian Wool Innovation, Stuart McCulloch, says the US riots add another layer of uncertainty to an economy and retail sector still reeling from the effects of COVID-19.
Look, all their doors over there in terms of retail garment-selling businesses, all those doors have been closed for a fair while. It's just another layer of damage that's being done to that economy. We always felt, or we felt for a little while, that China would emerge out of COVID probably the quickest because of their population and the affluence they have there now. And we thought the US wouldn't be far behind them, but we're starting to reassess that and make sure that, if we are deploying demand creation dollars and energy by way of our human resources we have there, that it's done in a place that's going to yield. And this is the issue we have at the moment.
So how do you see wool prices shaping up for the rest of the year? I mean, the prices have been in steady decline since 2018. Where is it heading now?
Yeah, look, we're trying to get a grip on that right now. It's very difficult to predict when you've got it. Literally every retail business in the world with their doors closed. What we're trying to understand is from our processes, whether they be in Italy or in China or anywhere else in the world, what sort of orders are coming through for the fall winter selling season. That's the Northern Hemisphere autumn winter selling season. You know, in some ways, COVID hit when the spring summer collections were going into store. So, and wool's not typically known to sell in spring summer. It can. There are some garments that are applicable, but wool is mostly sold in the autumn winter selling season. The purchasing for autumn winter is starting right now for fibre, and then it goes through the supply chain and into garments. And we're just trying to get a grip on, get more perfect information on what size those orders are that are coming through to the factories, wherever they might be, and whether they're down on last year's orders, cancelled from last year orders, or up on last year orders. We don't expect them to go up, mind you, but we're just trying to get a figure on what those downsizings of those orders are.
So it just depends on where that lands in terms of where the prices are heading, but it certainly doesn't sound promising.
It depends on how that country reopens, how they get those doors of those retail businesses reopened, how quickly normal life continues. It also depends on potentially when a vaccine comes through. So there's a whole lot of unknowns that we were dealing with at the moment. And from our point of view, we've largely shut down all our marketing projects temporarily to preserve those dollars, to make sure that we can discharge them at a time where it's going to yield for our wool growers.
So really just find out which market sort of comes out of this first, and that's where the focus, the money will go?
Absolutely. We've got a expanded our business intelligence unit of the company dramatically. We've turned those offices that we have overseas from project management businesses into really data collection offices, business intel offices, so that we can get more perfect information. It's very dangerous to make decisions with imperfect information, and it's very imperfect at the moment. In a month's time or a couple of months' time, it'll be a little bit more perfect, but still not absolutely perfect. So, look, we'll make those decisions on deployment of dollars and humans, resources, when we can get a clear picture on how that market's going to yield, how that company that we work with is going to yield for demand creation, and potentially categories of, you know, is it going to be formal apparel, or is it going to be casual apparel or technical apparel that's going to come out of this best?
CEO of Australian Wool Innovation, Stuart McCulloch, speaking there to Belinda Varaschetti. Now, a Victorian cropping farmer has been appointed an Officer of the Order of Australia for distinguished service to primary industry, in particular to grain, medicinal plant production and to seafood. Sherry von Hirschner spoke with Alan McCullum about the award to find out how a dryland producer from South Australia ended up in the game of cannabis and fish.
Oh, that's a long story, I suppose, but I got involved with Tassal in Tasmania, Australia's largest salmon grower, and currently we're also Australia's largest tiger prawn producer in Queensland. Back in 2005, when it was floated out of receivership, I got involved through networks in Melbourne that asked me to come on the board. I was on the board of Pivot and Instech Pivot. If you go back, Pivot owned 10% of Tassal and also the feed mills in Tasmania. So there was a linkage there, but it's certainly been a really good journey, and a good journey for health-conscious consumers, and a good journey for our 1,500 employees in Tasmania.
I'd imagine there must have been quite a bit to get your head around, particularly coming from a different form of agriculture.
Well, it is a learning, and it's been a fast learning curve to get involved initially, but at the end of the day, it's intensive animal production. It's just that they're all swimming around in the ocean, I suppose. We put 9.5 million fish in the ocean each year, and it's been using agricultural genetics and technologies. We've been able to, with selective breeding programs, take the harvest size from 2.6 kilos of fish to over 4.5 kilos of fish. So there's been a lot of high-tech agriculture being used, and we're applying the same principles with the prawn production up around northern Queensland.
Just having a look at your achievements over the years, you've had plenty of professional appointments. As you said, you were the chairman of Tassal Group. You were heavily involved in the Victorian Farmers Federation. You've won a number of awards. When you sort of think back over the time so far, what really stands out for you? What are you really proud of?
It was unexpected, the award, but it caused to have a rethink of just what I have been fortunate enough to be involved with. And I suppose it really stems from those early Victorian Farmers Federation days of trying to change the world in the grains industry. And I've participated in industries that have gone through considerable change with the grain industry. It was the privatisation of the Grain Elevators Board and the merger with GrainCorp. Pivot was a co-op coming into a commercial realities and a commercial world, and that merger in 2003. As I said, Tassal's come out of receivership and there's now an $800 million market cap. So they've all had growth, they've all had opportunities, but more importantly, they've all given opportunities for regional and rural Australia for jobs. And now the latest venture, which is now 6 years old, of course, is the CAN Group, the medical cannabis, which we'll see somewhere around 150 to 200 jobs created in Mildura, which will draw a whole range of different skills into that area, and they'll be sustainable 12 months of the year jobs. So I think that really does sit highly on any sort of thoughts I have about what's been achieved in that time is that opportunity for employment in rural areas.
You certainly grew up in sort of the age of Aquarius in the 70s. Do you ever stop and think how you would have thought back then whether you'd end up in the medicinal cannabis game?
It was probably, the National Service was the time of the Vietnam War, so there was a fair bit of cannabis allegedly around at that stage in the age of Aquarius, as you mentioned. Fortunately, none of it ever touched my lips. But to see the way that that's come about, and I think that's a real opportunity to change people's lives. While there's a lack of clinical trial data, which makes the medical profession a little reticent about prescribing, there's something like 5,000 new prescriptions a month going through the Therapeutics Goods Administration process, the SASCAT-B as they call it, and I think it's going to change a lot of lives, and there's an awful lot of anecdotal evidence out there how it's impacted on people. But there's no silver bullet, and it will need to go through that clinical trials, and I think we'll be in a good position with a world-class facility in Mildura producing at world-class competitive costs that will give us the ability to not only supply domestically but also export.
And that was Alan McCullum, and he's a Victorian cropping farmer who's been appointed an officer of the Order of Australia for distinguished service to primary industry. Now, have you ever thought about how much dog food your pet churns through each year? Coming up in the second half of the program, we'll unpack what those figures mean for grain production, and they might surprise you.
If everybody was to go out and get a Great Dane and replace their current dog with a Great Dane, that demand would increase from 450,000 tonnes to 1.5 million tonnes.
Not sure how many locals have Great Danes, but I reckon they eat a lot. Plus, we'll talk to Tasmanian wine and we'll talk to the young guns of wine. And now to the weather outlook for today and the rest of the week. We're speaking to Glenn Perrin. Hi, Glenn. How are you going?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Have we had any rainfall overnight?
Look, we've had some showers mainly around the west and far south. Highest falls to 19 include 7 millimetres at Mount Reid with 1 millimetre at Marrawar, King Island and Luncheon Hill. And since 9 a.m. we've had 1 millimetre at Strawn.
Okay, now the outlook.
We've got an area of high pressure to the north of Tasmania at the moment. That's directing a westerly flow over the state. So we'll see some light showers about the west and far south and possibly the Furneaux Islands, and it should be fine elsewhere. And on Tuesday, a high over the Tasman Sea will strengthen as a high over the southeast mainland weakens. That'll produce a northwesterly flow over Tasmania. We'll see some light showers about the north, west and far south and some areas of morning fog and frost. On Wednesday, the northwesterly flow will freshen as a cold front approaches from the southwest. Showers about the northwest and far south, and it should be fine elsewhere. In the order of 5 to 15 millimetres about the southwest, 2 to 5 millimetres about the rest of the west, and up to 2 millimetres in the north, particularly about the northeast highlands. Then on Thursday, the front will weaken as it crosses the state during the morning, with southerly winds turning light and variable later in the day as a high moves near the southwest of the state. So showers extend statewide through the morning, ease in the afternoon and then contract to the north as well as the south and east coast as we go through the evening. We'll see some snowfalls lowering to around 800 metres in the south through the day as well. So 5 to 10 millimetres in the west, 2 to 5 millimetres in the north and below 2 millimetres elsewhere. And then on Friday, the high will move to the southeast as an east-northeasterly flow develops. So some showers about the north and east should be generally fine elsewhere with some areas of morning frost in the order of 2 to 8 millimetres about the north and northeast, and up to 2 millimetres about the east coast.
Are there any warnings?
We're warnings-free for today, but for Tuesday we do have a strong warning for southern coastal waters. That's from Tasman Island to Low Rocky Point.
Right. Talking about waters, what about the rest of the coastal waters?
For the remainder of today, we're looking at northwest to southwesterly winds of 10 to 15 knots, although lighter and more variable in the upper east, and reaching up to 15 to 25 knots about the south. For Tuesday, west to northwesterly winds 10 to 20 knots, reaching 20 to 30 knots about the south. Those winds will tend northwesterly during the day. In terms of the swells in the west and south, the southwesterly swell in the order of 2 to 3 metres. The wave rider at the moment is on a 2.5 metre average, with a 4-metre maximum and a 12-second period. Cape Bruny at 9 a.m. is reporting a southwesterly at 1.5 metres, Matsocker Island a southwesterly at 2.5 metres, and Marrawar a southwesterly at 1 metre. In the north, we're looking at a westerly swell below 1 metre, and in the east, southerly around about the 1 metre mark, although southwesterly to 2 to 3 metres offshore in the south.
Glenn Perrin, thank you very much.
Not a problem. Hooroo then.
Now, Tassie has its fair share of winemakers in this year's top 50 of young guns of wine. But they were up there, but none of them actually took out any of the prizes. I think they did that the year before. It was the most unusual Young Gun of Wine Awards in its 14-year history. Like so many events, it switched to virtual. It was also the first time that the winner of the Young Gun of Wine took out the best new act in the same year. And only the second time a maker's taken home two trophies in the one year. Joining me now is organiser of the Young Gun of Wine event, Rory Kent. Hi, Rory.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, thank you. Thanks so much for joining the Country Hour from, I think you're in Victoria, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm in Melbourne, and thank you so much for having me and the interest.
Look, how did it go this year? I mean, it was obviously just such a crazy time to be running a national event like this.
Well, 2020 has been an amazingly intense year for all wine producers, as you'd no doubt be aware. We've seen bushfires across most of Australia that has hampered a lot of harvest and vintage for many producers. And then, having got through that, we'll hit with COVID-19, and that's what really impacted our plans for our 14th edition of the awards this year. So ordinarily, we would be doing a number of showcase events with our top 50 finalists across multiple cities, and so we had to quickly adjust and adapt our plans, and so that saw us doing a series of virtual events rather than our traditional events.
So managing to get all those 50 competitors or finalists in the virtual world.
Yes, well, what we did, we broke it into a series of bite-sized chunks. So we rolled out just over half a dozen events, and an each event we're featuring around eight or so winemakers. And so then through the entire series, we were able to give some airtime and attention to each of the top 50 winemakers to be able to tell their story, and then furthermore also connect them virtually to the event attendees, you might call them. We set up a system whereby any attendee could ask the winemakers a question live, and so
sounds quite like fun.
It was a lot of fun. And I think the silver lining in it is this changed environment pushed us to innovate digitally when we otherwise might not have, or at least not have done so soon. So
I'm sure more people probably got the chance to hook up and ask people questions, did they?
Well, that's right. When you take an event to a city, you're limited by the people that are within that city to attend, whereas the beauty of the online medium is that that you can be reaching a far greater audience. So that was the really exciting part.
Now, tell me about the winner of the Young Gun of Wine and the Best New Act Award.
So the winner of the Best New Act and Young Gun of Wine this year was Dilworth and Elaine. So they're a new producer in the Macedon Ranges, just north of Melbourne. Macedon Ranges is identified as the Australian mainland's coldest region, and This year we had four finalists from Macedon Ranges, and it's really such an exciting region when you have a look at the strength of those four finalists that we had from Macedon. So
are those people sort of starting up new vineyards, or are they working in established traditional vineyards, or?
It's a combination of both. In our awards, we're here for emerging winemakers and young wine labels. So we see amongst the top 50 this year, there's those people that are employed within established companies, typically younger winemakers within established companies doing exciting things. And then there are those who have their own business. And amongst those that have their own business, there are people who are sourcing grapes from different grape growers, whether in a single region or in multiple regions within a state, or indeed there's there's instances of people crossing state lines searching for the perfect grapes for them.
Lucky they were able to when they were in that winemaking.
Yeah, luckily the vintage and harvest period was before we were hit by COVID, that's right.
Now, I know with young guns of wine, there's often, you know, new styles or, you know, maybe heritage styles that they're bringing up and various varietals that they might be trying. Did you see a bit of that across the competition?
Oh, absolutely. So you look at the... each winemaker puts forward two wines into our showcase, and you look amongst the 50 winemakers that have made the top 50 this year and their 100 wines, and you're seeing all sorts of grape varieties, and then overlaid with that is all sorts of different winemaking approaches and styles. So, you know, if in terms of grape varieties, beyond, you know, the regular varieties that most people have heard of, you've got things like Vermentino, Torriga Nacional, Gewurz Tremina, Nero d'Avola, Montepulciano, Moscato, Cabernet Franc, Pinot Meunier, Gamay, Sangiovese, and the list goes on. And then overlaid with that, you've got the people's different winemaking approaches with those great materials. So there's a few people that were doing infusions with wine. You know, we had a winemaker from Margaret River making fortified wine. There's winemakers making their wines in amphora, which are these ancient, you might call them the original fermentation vessel that these large terracotta urns that are buried underground.
There's always someone doing something interesting in that competition.
Absolutely. So you know, within the wines, you do see those that are pursuing fine wine and honing and refining conventional styles of wines, and that can be exciting. And then as well, there's this really strong thread of experimentation amongst the winemakers. I think when you see people striking out and doing their own thing from a practical perspective, you know, it's probably easier for them to market their product if they're going to the market with a different story. And so that's what you see.
Something a bit different.
Absolutely. Mm. That's what you see in our awards, you know, a strong degree of differentiation amongst all of the winemakers.
Well, Rory Kent, organiser of the Young Guns of Wine. Tassie still did really well, having quite a few people in that top 50.
Absolutely. I mean, Tasmania is punching well above the wine region's rate.
A good place young winemakers, isn't it?
Oh, it's fantastic. I mean, it's a brilliant place to be growing grapes, and you know, Tasmania makes 1% of Australia's wine output, but in our showcase this year, six of the 50 producers were from Tasmania. So that's something like 12% of our top 50 list. So you know, there's an extraordinary band of Tasmanian winemakers in there that probably, you know, over represent, and that's because, you know, there's some exciting talent down in Tasmania. There's a lot of people that have specifically packed up their gear and migrated to Tasmania just to make grapes there, because, you know, it's a place that's so well suited for cool climate varietal wines.
Okay, Rory Kent from Young Guns of Wine, thanks so much for joining the Country Hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
Catch you next time.
Next time. Thank you.
From the creator of Rake,
nuclear is our future.
A political satire, spy thriller and murder mystery.
I thought you built towers.
Yes, from which they drop atom bombs.
Starring Jessica DeGaulle.
You have or have had a spy here.
James Cromwell.
I have been told that there are no Aborigines in this region.
And Ewan Leslie.
I'd walk away and steer clear of Maralinga for the rest of your lives.
Operation Buffalo continues 8:30 Sunday on ABC TV and iView.
The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
Now, it may be a case of old is new again in the Derwent Valley. The Derwent Valley Catchment Project is working with farmers to trial different types of pastures for some of their toughest paddocks. Some heritage varieties will be tested out on these wind-whipped, sun-drenched and overloved slopes to see which ones are hardiest and which ones help put condition on livestock. The key to this project is which one also works for the farmer's bottom line. We're on one of the high spots on this farm and we can see down into the Derwent Valley and we can see the Derwent River snaking along. It's quite green at the moment, but the pastures are sparse. When you have a close look, you can see that there's not much to it. And that's one of the big problems here in the Derwent Valley. A lot of these north-facing slopes have sparse pastures, and that's why we're here today. We're here to look at the possibility of a pasture trial to try and work out which pasture types will actually last, will help fatten the livestock, and will be cost-effective. Bob Shoebridge, when I come to farms in the Derwent Valley, there's always this wind. There's always north-facing hills that are hard on pasture. Is this one of them that we're looking at now? What are the problems with this sort of paddock?
Well, as you said, it's a very windy area right through here. It's prone to blowing. Sheep take a lot of shelter on this bank as well. And in the summer, it gets extremely hot. And also in the winter, this bank... We also have the sheep sitting on this bank to try and get warm from the north-facing sun.
Well, that's part of the problem, isn't it? Livestock actually prefer them.
Yes, they do. They do, to get their little sunbaking on during the day. And
So do you have a problem keeping pasture or having pasture that's good enough for feed on these sort of paddocks?
Well, we do, because of the animals keep on coming to the same areas to take shelter or to sunbake, as I said, and... Yes, it is hard, so we try and get a good mix of coxfoot and clover to try and bind the structure of the soil and everything together to hold it in place. As you can see where we are at the moment, it's taken a toll and we need to do something about it.
Well, it can't be a cost-effective paddock really, can it?
Well, there's bugger all here really, to be honest. There's a bit of capeweed and just a few rocks and a bit of red dirt and cow poo and sheep poo.
An ideal trial site, do you think?
Well, we're facing directly north, so I think what we're trying to achieve here is would be a perfect site for what we need to do.
Is part of this trial important to you because they're looking at the economics, though? Because it's sort of easy to try different things, but it's got to sort of fit in the bottom line, doesn't it?
Well, it does. You have to put it in your budget to, put new grasses in.
Is it a big expense for you?
It is. We're constantly putting new pastures in, mainly after poppies. We haven't done much where we are at the moment. After the 2012 fires, we re-sowed it and re-drilled it with coxfoot and clover. And we had a great success with that because it was completely black. We could see where we've been and it was just completely bare.
So really, looking at these green hills now, and they're not often green, are they? You've done quite well considering you actually burnt out during those fires.
Yes, I think we've done incredibly well, and the neighbouring farms as well. We did a few little trials in fern beds, trying to re-establish fern beds so they didn't wash. But unfortunately, all the ferns came back, which isn't ideal. Over the next couple of years, I think we're going to start just to put new pastures in. Even a mix of turnips as well, just to try and get rid of all the capeweed and nasty weeds and just try and make this into a profitable enterprise.
What sort of livestock do you have here?
We run prime lambs as well as merino for wool. We've got Angus cattle, so we've got about 4,000 breeding ewes and about 2,000 crossbred lambs. And about 300 Angus cattle.
Peter Bull, you're the Agricultural Extension Officer.
That's exactly right,
for this project, so that means you'll be organising the trial.
Yep.
What sorts of pastures will be involved in this trial, and how will you do it here?
Okay, yeah, so we're going to look at a range of probably coxfoots and phalarises with a few other things for points of comparison as single grass sowings with a legume, with one legume component as well. So some clover and other legume options trialled across some of those cultivars of coxfoot and phalarises, the primary comparisons. Against this background vegetation, which as you can see has got a lot of capeweed, a bit of erodium, and just a background of and some a little bits of phalaris and coxfoot left over from past sowings.
How much will you put in, and how will you do it?
We'll go with a best practice approach, if you like. So we'll actually drill it in where we can. So we're trying to select a site where we can get the drill into the ground, place the seed, follow the recommendations for the sowing rate, with not skimping on the legume. Try to get enough legume into the system as well. We're just trying to look to options which might improve the productivity of that, and clover will be a part of that.
So better feed, basically.
Better feed quality, and addressing one of the key limits to productivity in the nitrogen supply to the pasture.
And one of the key problems with the Derwent Valley?
I think across Tasmania, clover is often an issue, or the limited amount of clover within the pastures is often an issue. We get to areas where there's lots of stress from climate and season-to-season stress, then that puts another layer of limitation there. So addressing that, looking to see how we can address it by having the most resilient, the best adapted species in the system is one of our goals.
Eve Lazarus is with the Derwent Catchment Project and is coordinating this program. Eve, it's a tough job, isn't it? They've got to be pretty hardy in this area.
Yeah, definitely. It's it is a really challenging environment, dryland grazing in the Derwent. We've got, you know, short growing seasons. The soils are so variable. Some pastoralists we work with say there's like five types on one paddock even. Really low rainfall, obviously. In some areas it's classified as semi-arid, so under 600 mils annually. And yeah, those tricky north-facing slopes, which, you know, they're prone to soil erosion, as we all know, as we come out here sometimes during the year, and you really do see that in the landscape. So that's the reality of dryland grazing in this area.
And you finally got some reasonable funding to go ahead and do something about it, or to at least look at what is the most cost-effective way to do something about it.
Yeah, that's right. So we're working through the Australian Government's National Landcare Program, funded by NRM South. They're supporting us financially out here so that we can do a three-year program. Targeted way, we're working with the graziers of the Derwent, and we've got a really passionate team, lots of pasture knowledge and extension experience, but we're focused on working with people out here, so it's about distilling the knowledge of pastoralists across the region. So getting their knowledge about how they manage the difficult situations and try to share that with other people, as well as looking at current research and how we can integrate that.
Well, they've been through a lot out here, haven't they? Fire, drought, heat, and now it's back to winter, so these pastures need to be pretty tough.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, we've had a really great autumn break, so a lot of people are saying that's the best in, you know, 30 years. But the seasonal variation is a real killer. It's a tricky thing, so managing variation in the season. So we're really trying to help people create a more resilient farming system for the future climate, but also even to manage that variation. So what we're looking at, what we can do to support dryland grazers in getting more resilience on their farms so that they can be proactive rather than having to react.
And what sort of funding did you get?
We got money through the Australian Government's National Landcare Program, and that's given us 3 years of work out here. The program's really quite broad. It's very varied, so there's lots of components. We've got grazing time, which is a series of on-farm workshops looking at how to get the most out of your dryland grazing. We're doing a mentor program, so teaming up with local leaders on a particular subject and then, like, get them to work with someone so that they can do it in a one-on-one personal way. We're going to have lots of regular workshops and field days and seminars. COVID's obviously thrown a bit of a spanner in the works there, but we're doing some podcasts and some video to just overcome that for the minute. But we're hoping to get back out on farm when the restrictions allow that. The other thing we're doing is the demonstration sites, which are really core to this project, because we want to work with people to overcome the issues as they arise, and we want to get feedback for how these things work, and we want to know the cost and the benefit. So a lot of times extension work comes out and goes, oh, you know, you guys should do this. Our question is, great, well, how much does that cost, and what are the productivity gains of that, so that we can really show people in a local context that it can, or how it stacks up, and then you're more likely to get adoption.
And that was Eve Lazarus and Peter Ball from the Derwent Valley Catchment Project, and Farmer Bob Shoebridge from the Fenton Forest Farm in the Derwent Valley, all working on a trial of pastures. Which ones are the economic and ecological winners? Now, dogs have long been a farmer's companion and often best worker, But could they also be helping out on the agriculture supply chain front as well? Market analyst Andrew Whitelaw heard all about the dog adoptions during coronavirus and wanted to see just how much effect dogs have on the meat and grain markets.
Well, it's quite considerable, actually. And basically, at the current levels of dog ownership in Australia, it's about 450,000 tonnes of dog food per year, which is quite a lot.
That's a lot. Did you expect it would be that much?
If I'm completely honest, I had no expectations whatsoever going into this. But it was a robust analysis, and yeah, I really had no idea. There's no real data out there to show how much food goes into the dog herd, and yeah, it was eye-opening for me in that it was as high as that.
So how did you work this out?
I thought it was going to be a very simple analysis. Somebody will have done this before. But what I had to do was basically work out a proxy for how popular each breed of dog is in Australia. And to let you know, there's 220 breeds of dog listed, which is a lot of different types of dogs, from Great Danes to Shih Tzus. And what I then had to do is work out, well, what weight is each dog? So I had to go through every single dog breed and then put a note down for what weight each dog was, which allowed me to then create what is effectively a weighted average of all the dogs in Australia. And just so you know, the average dog in Australia is 22 kilos.
Okay, so a medium-sized dog.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. You made it sound simple, but I had to put a lot of work in to work it out. So many of your listeners will know that there's basically a feed conversion ratio for if you're feeding sheep, cattle, or pigs or chooks, and obviously it's fairly similar to a dog. There's a certain amount of food that is required to maintain a dog, and when you work all that out and you use this sort of theoretical model, in theory, dogs are being fed about 450,000 tons of food per year.
So how much difference would that make to, say, the grains industry?
Well, look, 140,000 tonnes is not huge, but, you know, every little helps. And, you know, 140,000 tonnes is two Panamaxes of grain and a little bit extra. Better to have it than not have it. And, yeah, so it is a small section of demand, but it is a driver of demand. And it applies as much to the meat industry as well as the grains industry. But if we were to encourage everybody to buy a Great Dane and get rid of their Shih Tzu and upgrade to a Great Dane, then that would have a fairly large impact upon grain requirements because a Great Dane clearly eats a lot more than a Shih Tzu. So to give you an example, we were talking about 450,000 tons of demand at present. If everybody was to go out and get a Great Dane and replace their current dog with a Great Dane, that demand would increase from 450,000 tons to 1.5 million tons. So maybe it's time for the grains industry or the agricultural industry to get in bed with the Great Dane Breeders Association and start marketing Great Danes as a dog that you should have.
I don't know how they'll go herding livestock or fitting into some small apartments.
No, and they might not fit into many small studio apartments in the middle of Melbourne or Adelaide.
Do your bit for the grain industry and buy a Great Dane. That was market analyst Andrew Whitelaw speaking to Cassie Huff, and we'll catch you again on Monday. Oh, tomorrow, Tuesday.
Leon Compton.
Morning tea and lunchtime. You had nowhere to wash your hands or anything.
You say you were covered from head to toe. What sort of protection were you wearing against those chemicals?
None.
Weekdays from 8:30 a.m. on ABC Radio Hobart.